This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Kevin Lin. He runs the organization Progressives for Immigration Reform. Kevin, it's great having you on the show.
Well, I'm glad you have me on today, Robert. Good to meet you over Skype.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hi, Sam. How you doing?
Good. It's good to be on again, Rob.
Kevin, can you talk about your background prior to forming Progressives for Immigration Reform?
Sure. We had started Progressives for Immigration Reform about 9 years ago, and it grew out of an attempt to have a discussion with my brothers and sisters in the progressive movement and Democratic Party on the unanticipated consequences of unbridled immigration. We're not just talking illegal immigration, which is part of that equation, but also when you look at the large amount of immigration that takes place every year in the United States. And those unintended consequences are borne by some of the most vulnerable parts of our society, as well as the environment.
Have you traditionally been more on the left for most of your life?
Well, when people ask what my political persuasion is, I tell them I am a lapsed Republican, a unrepentant Perotist, a failed Green Party member, and I was for a very long period of time a very frustrated member of the Democratic Party. I was part of the progressive movement that sprung out of 2004.
About the Kucinich campaign.
Correct. Kucinich and Dean. And it's funny, it's great that you brought that up, because in 2004, it was really easy to spot the progressives. They were either wearing Kucinich swag or they were wearing Dean swag. So, you know, that's what, you know, when you looked at the progressive world at the time, that was it. And then we took back the Congress in 2006, and at that point, everyone became a progressive.
You also have a blog, Center for Progressive Urban Politics. What would you say is a focal point of that site?
Well, that site, we like to look at all the issues. With PFER, I really focus on immigration, but with CFPUP, we look at a broad range of issues. Some of them are social justice. Others get into population, others get into the environment, labor, crime, corruption, the corporatocracy, the deep state, and how it impacts us. Also looking at state and local politics. So it's a much more broad-ranging, a lot of far-ranging topics are covered there other than immigration.
So with Progressives for Immigration Reform, the key issue is how large levels of immigration affect workers' rights, wages, and the environment?
Yes, absolutely. And I look at those as being unintended consequences.
So one thing you point out on your site is there's been a kind of long tradition of progressives and environmentalists criticizing immigration. You can go back to Barbara Jordan and Eugene McCarthy, but then there's also the whole issue with the vote in the Sierra Club, which I think was in the 90s. Then you go back further to the 60s, and then you had David Brower, who was the executive director of the Sierra Club.
Right. If you look at, well, it's, maybe it's a good idea to go in chronological order. When you look, let's go back to 1924. Where we had the Immigration Act, it's called the 1924 Immigration Act. And up to that point, decreasing immigration was a platform of the populist movements. To paraphrase Samuel Gompers, the fellow who eventually formed the AFL-CIO, he looked at the need to control immigration because it was the tool of the chambers of commerce that they would use to flood the labor markets and not allow them to gain a foothold, the unions to gain a foothold through labor scarcity. So they would flood the markets, Labor was abundant. In many cases, it was in oversupply, and they were able to force down wages as well as stymie attempts to organize labor. And then, of course, you had the lobbying of ethnic groups that wanted to see the door left open for more of their countrymen. And it, as I mentioned, it was a populist plank, and the Immigration Act of 1924 significantly limited immigration for the first time in the United States. And that was a populist plank.
So you're talking about the original labor movement. At what point did the labor movement change their position?
Well, interesting enough, it wasn't until 1965. And it was at that time that, you know, for instance, Robert Kennedy was one of the framers of the Immigration Reform Act of 1965. And the idea was to take out those elements that a lot of folks found kind of repugnant in our immigration system. And that was the focus on Northern European. For instance, when I look at the, trying to remember what the stats were at the time, but we had roughly 70% of all immigrants, those slots went to people from Great Britain, Ireland, and Germany. And Asian countries, for instance, were limited to just 100 slots a year. So there was definitely racism, xenophobia at work there. And the idea was to change that. And so for a lot of good intentions, we liberalized our immigration policies at the time. But as I mentioned, the idea was, yes, let's change the mix of who's coming in, but let's not change the numbers. For instance, if I can recall correctly, Robert Kennedy stated, first, our cities will not be flooded with 1 million immigrants annually. Under the proposed bill, which is the Immigration Reform, which became the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, the present level of immigration remains substantially the same.
One thing that is interesting with that Immigration Act of 65 is that played a major factor, but throughout the 70s, there was a number of, say, 400,000 a year, and people know about that, and they know about the Reagan amnesty, but one thing people don't know about is Bush Sr. signed a bill that increased the cap. I think it was up to 1 million. Are you familiar with that?
Right. Right now, we let in about 1.2. We allot about 1.2 million green cards a year, and almost half of that allotment goes to family reunification, and that was a direct impact of the Immigration Reform Act of 1965.
I don't know the specific name, but are you familiar with that act I'm talking about, and that was signed in the early 90s by Bush Sr.?
I'm vaguely familiar with it, but I couldn't give you the name of the act off the top of my head. I'd have to research that.
With the whole environmental angle, a lot of the original figures in the Sierra Club, you talk about David Brower,
Paul Joseph Watson, several other distinct, Frank Morris, a number of very distinguished members in the Sierra Club were, I mean, it really was a civil war, because the Sierra Club at the time understood, certainly up until this point, understood that the demand that an ever increasing population put on the environment was not a good thing. The idea was to stabilize, if not eventually reduce, the population. And by 1972, we had actually stabilized the population of the U.S. Anecdotally speaking, Nixon had thought that would be a good place to begin stabilizing the population at. And that is the frustrating thing, to particularly in a country like the United States, where our carbon footprints are so much greater than many of the countries that we receive immigrants from. For instance, it was in 2008, a really good peer-reviewed article was written by Paul Murtagh and Michael Schlacks. They're members of the Department of Statistics at Oregon State University. And they were able to come up with relative carbon footprints for different countries. And they pegged the U.S. at about, per capita, about 20 tons per year. And now contrast that to Mexico, where we get 27% of our immigrants each year from. And that we're looking at about 3.67 tons per year per person. So that's significant. And we need to look at the impact of population here, because if you're like myself and you believe in anthropogenic climate change, where it's attributed to human consumption and our waste, you should be looking at the very seriously at the population increase in the United States.
There was this whole debate in the Sierra Club, I think this was the 90s, where they were going to vote whether to say that immigration plays a role in environmental degradation. And there was some billionaire financier who basically bribed the organization not to take that stance.
Yeah, exactly. And that happened, it was 1994. And it really created a bitter division within the Sierra Club. And I'm trying to think of the fellow's name who was that billionaire. I know he had written an algorithm that Wall Street had used, but I can't quite recall who his name was. It will come to me in a moment. But yes, he donated a large sum of money to the Sierra Club. And basically, he told them not to talk about immigration.
Was there a strong divide among the members themselves as well?
Sure. You had folks like one director was Ben Zuckerman, a professor of physics and astronomy at UCLA. He was one. Paul Joseph Watson was another one. All of them, John Tanton, others who were directors in the Sierra Club, who believed that we needed to talk about population stabilization.
And I think one of the key factors is the original environmental movement, or the movement in the 60s and 70s. This was coming as a reaction to the baby boom, so immigration wasn't as big of a factor today. But today, the reason it's become politically incorrect is because if you look at native-born population growth, it's pretty much stable. Most population growth is a product of immigration, so that's probably why I see the key factor as the environmental movement and the left changing their position on that.
Yeah, it always kind of struck me as odd. Here we are in the baby boom. Which we're just seeing the front end of that, in the 1960s, that we chose to increase the number of immigrants. So, our population was increasing at a much faster clip. So, it really kind of struck me as odd that was a time you would think that if the demographics were different and our birth rates were down and our population growth was either getting to zero or negative, at that point, you'd start to look at increasing immigration. So it leads me to think that the Immigration Reform Act of 1965 might have been really a diversity social experiment, as opposed to something that was well thought out on the grounds of the impact it would have on labor and the impact it would have on the environment. Oh, and by the way, the fellow that had donated the $100 million to the Sierra Club in 1994. His name was David Gelbaum.
Are you primarily just concerned with the levels of immigration, or do you think the geographic composition matters? Do you think it's an issue of, say, one country taking up a large slot?
No, I think it is an issue of numbers. On face, it's an issue of numbers, because a friend of mine, Jeanette Christensen, aptly stated, if you believe one person matters, you have to believe the numbers matter. And that's where I am in my head, in my space on this issue. It's very difficult to have a conservation program if you do not have a population stabilization program.
So would you consider yourself a civic nationalist if you've, like, are you familiar with that term?
I'm not familiar with the term civic nationalist. Now, I understand nationalist, nationalism. If you want to define your take on that term, I'd love to hear it. But and then I'll give my input. How about that?
Okay, a civic nationalist is somebody that believes that anybody should be able to come here, but if they come here, they should obey the law, they should respect the Constitution, and that they should share the beliefs and the values that are expected in American society. They should have American values and respect for the Constitution, basically.
No, I would say I certainly agree with that. In fact, a quote from Otis Graham regarding the 1924 Immigration Act reads that the 1924 Act was instrumental in creating a 40-year breathing space of relatively low immigration that allowed for assimilation and helped give rise to the Great Society. I think when you look at... you had James Kunstler on recently.
Oh, yes.
And he talks about, in his book, Too Much Magic, the delusion, something about too much delusional thinking or something like that, if I recall the title incorrectly in this case. He talks about, when you look at the challenges that are confronting us, we have peak oil, we have climate change, we have environmental degradation and issues arising from that, to include things like ocean acidification. We have the loss of open spaces and farmlands and drinking water that isn't polluted. There's a whole host of issues. And it's difficult to arrive at solutions when there aren't shared common values. I'm not going to say cultures. We're all multicultural. I'm the son of an immigrant. But as a nation, there are values that we must share, I think, in order to be successful. I look at Germany, and we're talking about population. Their population growth is about 0.02%. So they're getting near zero, almost bordering on negative. But as a common culture, they're able to look at these problems. For instance, when Angela Merkel said we're going to get off the nukes, their nuclear power, and replace that with renewable energy, they can. Because in 70 years, there'll be half as many Germans as there are today.
Well, what about the whole situation with the migrant crisis? Does that change things there?
I think it's a temporary right. I don't know. Well, when you say you're talking about the recent migrant crisis.
Yeah, not the recent situation.
Well, I think that's that is a crisis, and it's a small crisis now, and it's going to get ever larger, because when you look at what is going on in these sending countries, economically, politically, resource wise. People are becoming more and more desperate to get to a country like Europe, where in some cases they can simply survive. And I think it's going to be a continuing problem. But again, that's just one of these crisis points, one of these crisis issues that countries are going to have to react to and attempt to successfully navigate. And I think it's easier to do that with a population that shares your values.
I know a lot of people on the left, they look at the issues of environmentalism and immigration. They say we're all citizens of the world, so immigration doesn't matter. But I think you touched on this earlier. The key crucial point is if someone moves from one country to, say, here, their ecological footprint vastly increases.
Yes. I mean, let's look at, let's compare China and the United States. China, in terms of its carbon footprint as a country, the aggregate is larger than the United States. However, individually, it's 3.62 tons per year, significantly smaller than the United States. So if we move someone from China to the U.S., we're only going to increase pollution. And then also, as countries develop, they're going to want the things like automobiles and the kind of convenient appliances and conveniences that come with being a developed country. That only increases the carbon footprint. So to me, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to have so much immigration. And we need to look at immigration, again, in perspective. When my mother came here in 1952, we let out 178,000 green cards that year. We're over a million green cards a year in the United States. And that's not counting for the illegal immigration. So it's something that, it's something I think we really need to react to. And there's a point where prudence simply dictates that we lower immigration.
On your website, you have a U.S. population projections that are based on current levels of immigration, hypothetical levels if we increased immigration or reduced immigration. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. A couple years ago, we we developed a environmental impact study looking at population and the impact that it was going to have on urban sprawl, the environment in general, basically arguing that when we look at immigration policy and we look to increase the number of immigrants allowed in per year, we should be actually be invoking NEPA and asking for an environmental impact study to accompany that. And that was the purpose of doing that. So we looked at these different scenarios. And as you could imagine, if we continue on the way we are, we're going to get in much more desperate stakes as we move forward. Let me pull those numbers up now, because they are significant. So if we're looking at, for instance, if we do nothing, kind of keep things the way they are, by the year 2100, the population of the country will be 379 million.
What is it right now? It's a little over 300.
Little over 300. We would see an uptick of over 379 million, but by 2000, by 2100, it will come down. If we have the number, will be by the year 2100 at 524 million. So there's a lot of discussion on the RAISE Act, which is a bill sponsored by Congressman Cotton and Senators Cotton and Senators Perdue.
And so is that one projection based on a complete moratorium, or if we implement the RAISE Act at 400,000?
No, at 370. Oh, no, it would be basically cutting our immigration levels in half.
Then you have the projection of about $500 million is based on current levels.
Yeah, when you look at approximately 1.25 million a year coming through, we're looking at adding another 200 million people to the population. And that's a lot. That's a lot of folk. Now, there are those that would like to increase population beyond 1.25 million. And some are asking for 2.25 million. And that would be devastating, I believe, because we're looking at a projection of 669 million people, doubling our population by the year 2100. And I don't think we're doing a very good job of managing our environment and our ecosystems now with the population we have.
Can you talk more about the RAISE Act? So primarily the two main things about it are the point system and the cap at 400,000 a year. You see the second part as being the most crucial about it, but what are your overall thoughts on it? And what is the practicality of it being passed?
Okay, let's look at the different features of the RAISE Act. As you'd mentioned, there's a point system, and that point system looks at things like age, education. There's also an investment aspect to it, a family reunification aspect to it. And when you look at the RAISE Act, it should reduce the number of immigrants by 41% in the first year of its implementation. And we'll get into how it does that in a moment. And then by about 50% over the course of 10 years. Number one, it eliminates what they call the diversity lottery. And the lottery grants about 50,000 green cards to immigrants from low admission countries. Again, it's part of a kind of a diversity lottery in many respects. And it would also cap refugees allowed in the country at 50,000. And you had mentioned the point system, which is all part of what they call a merit-based system, for instance. And the idea is to encourage the most productive and, let's just say, most apt to be successful to immigrate to the U.S. And, you know, for instance, in this point system, you have to garner 30 points to be admitted. And if you're under 17, you get 0 points for that. Now, if your age is 31 to 35, you get 8 points, which is the highest point level that you can get in the age category. And then from that 31 to 35, it begins to go down. So for instance, ages 36 to 40, 6 points, 41 to 45, 4 points. 46 to 52 points, and 51 and older, 0 points. And the purpose there, again, is to really focus on bringing the most productive folks into the country possible.
Yes, I just want to give an objection that ethno-nationalists often give to that type of try and bring in the best and most talented people, productive people possible from other countries. Mm-hmm. The problem with that people who are on the nationalist side, the ethno-nationalist side would argue, is that it leads to a brain drain where the most talented and productive people are leaving these countries, and these countries, let's say you get doctors from Pakistan, the best doctors from Pakistan, bring them to the United States, Pakistan has less doctors now. So the countries that these people immigrate from suffer from that.
I don't disagree with a thing you said. In fact, Frank Morris, the chairman of the Board of Progressives for Immigration Reform, is adamant up on the whole topic of brain drain. We're really not helping anyone. This is why earlier this year we commissioned and now have in place an H-1B visa database that's accessible on the PFIR website. So you can literally go there and search your zip code, your city, and find out the exact, the number of H-1B visa applications in your area. And when you see this data, you can begin to understand the brain drain that's going on. For instance, to that point, we bring in 3,500 foreign trained physicians a year. And as you mentioned, this brain drain, we're taking these very talented people and bringing them to the U.S. where there could very well be much greater need for them if they're in Nigeria, if they're in India, other countries that might really need doctors. And the problem here, again, this is, and a lot of that came out of the 1990s when we had a shortage of doctors, but we don't anymore. And I'll give you a great example of this. We have roughly 9,000 medical students, oh, not medical students, but doctors who have graduated from medical school and have not been able to get a residency. And all we would have to do is knock that 3,500 number of foreign trained physicians that we bring in every year that I mentioned earlier, knock that down to 2,500 or 2,000, and all of those doctors would be able to get into a residency program. And so imagine graduating from medical school with $250,000, $300,000, $400,000 in debt and not being able to get a job as a doctor, which if you don't get into a residency program, you can't.
So with the whole healthcare debate and the cost of healthcare, would you say the issue of high cost of healthcare is more to do with insurance companies gouging than shortages of doctors?
Well, there are a number of culprits in this. And one of them is the medical community itself that has limited the number of medical schools and graduates in order to create scarcity in that labor market and keep fees high. We need to do a better job there, I believe. Obviously, I'm a person who supports a single-payer system. I always had. I was in the military for 10 years. And I think of the bones I'd broken and the accidents I had and never had to worry about a deductible. You know, every American should not have to worry about a deductible for themselves or their children. So I think it would certainly... Would that system create in itself a greater demand for doctors and healthcare? Hard to say, but that's pretty multifaceted in that you also have to look at things like the diet of the average American, exercise levels, and things like that. And a healthcare system that focuses on getting people well as opposed to keeping them well.
You talked about your H-1B visa statistics on your website. Can you talk more about the H-1B program? Would you like to see it abolished altogether?
Well, the program was created as a way, and again, this gets back to Sam's early comment, to drain the best brains from around the world and bring them to the United States. And when you look at the program, it really doesn't do that because there are four levels in the H-1B visa program. Level one are college graduates, college graduates. Level two are people that I would consider qualified, have been in the workforce for a few years. Level three, more skilled. Level four, highly skilled. Anyone want to venture a guess on what percent of all H-1B visa holders are levels three and four?
Of highly skilled, maybe 20% or 15%.
Levels four, three and four, 6%. 94% are levels one and two.
So basically, it's not bringing in the best and brightest, pretty much average workers who are depressing wages of the average American workers.
Absolutely. And that was recently revealed by an expose done by 60 Minutes and how, for instance, workers at Walt Disney were fired and told they had to replace their H-1B visa replacements or they wouldn't get a severance, any severance pay. This is really despicable, and it's a practice that's been allowed to continue. So when you asked, would I say get rid of the H-1B visa program altogether? I would say no, but let's get rid of levels one and two. For instance, I had met with a board of trustee of a community college, and he was sympathetic to what I was saying with regard to the H-1B program and getting rid of levels one and two. And I said, well, when you look at your city, the salaries that are going to level one college graduates, people that are competing directly with the people, your newly minted graduates, those combined salaries were $44,308,000, roughly 430 some positions, if I recall, were level one. And the level two were $55 million. Over $55 million in aggregate salary in that city going to foreign nationals. And these are for jobs that American won't hold for 3 years, and if they renew the application, won't hold for 6 or 9 years. So it's definitely having an impact. We're not able to, and when you think of it too, think of the debt that students acquire to earn a degree and earn skills, whether it's in computer science or accounting. And all of a sudden now they're competing with someone with nothing near that debt load and is willing to and is prepared to work for less. So, yeah, I would say the way to fix H-1B is to get rid of levels one and two.
And it's not just for the tech industry. As you were saying, it's for multiple industries, a lot of different industries.
Absolutely. Well, one of the most interesting things when we were reviewing the data that was going into our H-1B visa database, we were finding positions like golf groundskeeper, front desk clerk, activities director, production assistant. So absolutely right. These are not just quote unquote tech jobs out there, as I mentioned there. And then when you look, they're also in the other professions. Accounting is a big one as well. As I'd mentioned earlier, medical and healthcare, also areas where we have a lot of H-1B visas coming in. So it's not just computer programmers and IT desk operators.
What are your thoughts on Bernie Sanders' comment he said in an interview? Didn't he say open borders was a Koch brothers conspiracy? Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with that. And I was living in Los Angeles when he did his first rally during the primary. And I was hoping to speak with him and discuss just that with him. However, I didn't get to discuss it with him, but I did go to the rally, and he brought a number of dreamers out on stage, and we never heard that or anything. We never heard anything again from him about limiting immigration. So I think he realized that within the Democratic Party, you couldn't touch that, whether he somewhere personally planned to revisit it later down the road, I'm not sure, but clearly there was a point in his career where he understood the impact of supply and demand on labor and understood the interest that wanted to see unbridled immigration.
And as far as Donald Trump goes, he has come out in support of the RAISE Act. What are your general thoughts on his environmental stances, including global warming, his EPA appointment, and his positions on public lands?
Well, I didn't vote for him. I didn't vote for her either. And I cringed when I've seen his pronouncements on anything dealing with the environment. I cringe when I saw who he put in as the director EPA. So I am not a big fan of his environmental policies. I think a lot of work needs to be done there. But I think the left is a little bit responsible there in that one of the first things that Trump did when he became president was end the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, just wrote that treaty right off. And he really should have gotten accolades and applause from the left at that point, and he didn't. Now, if he would have, would he have thought, well, maybe if I kind of schmooze the left, you know, if they like me for doing this, I'll keep doing it. We will never know that. But he certainly, when you look at who he's appointed and his rhetoric, not a friend to the environment. But he does support the RAISE Act. And we were talking about the different aspects of the RAISE Act earlier. Maybe we should complete that, because I think it is important. We talked about the points for age. There's also points for education that are allotted up to 13 points, or actually up to 15 points can be allotted for certain degrees. And for instance, winners of Olympics or winners of Nobel laureates, they can get as much as 15 points or 25 points, depending on the combinations. There's also, if an applicant agrees to invest $1,350,000 in a new commercial initiative and for a few years, that can get them like 6 points. The most significant thing I think it will do is it's going to eliminate family sponsorship beyond a spouse and minor children. And as I'd mentioned earlier, they're going to drop who is a child from 21 down to 18. And the whole family category itself is going to drop from 226,000 green cards presently allotted each year to just 88,000. So that's where we're going to see the biggest immediate reductions in the RAISE Act.
What do you think about the feasibility of it being passed with a lot of these? You have on one side, you have the corporate Republicans like Paul Ryan, and I doubt most of the Democratic Party is going to support it either.
Boy, you know, I was in D.C. the last couple of days, and I'm hearing rumors that Paul Ryan would come down in support of the RAISE Act and a few other acts that are out there. There are other acts that are out there. For instance, H.R. 392, Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants, that's not something I support.
Explicitly does that do?
Well, it amends the Immigration and Nationality Act to eliminate the per country numerical limitation for employment-based immigrants. So we're going to see that, for instance, the per country numerical limitation for family-based immigrants will rise from 7 to 15% of the total number, which will be the total number of family-sponsored visas. But there's also H.R. 2724, the Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Act. And this is basically they're going to replace the diversity visa program with a new program where someone who wants to pay $1 million can get an application. You know, currently we have the EB-5 visa in place, and that, you know, these are not good programs because they're really not doing anything but either just doing diversity for diversity's sake or pandering to wealthy individuals. Like, for instance, the current EB-5 investor program. So if you're a foreign national and you claim to want to start a business, you can invest, quote unquote, $500,000 and get a green card. And I don't think that's necessarily fair. Certainly the RAISE Act has more restrictions on that, and they look at that investment a lot more closely given the language of the bill. But Yeah, there's a half a dozen other acts to include Senate Bill, the Integrity in Border and Immigration Enforcement Act. It's by Durbin. There's a another Senate bill to strengthen border security. That's Senate Bill 1757. There's several other acts out there that could be before Congress in the Senate. But of all of them, I'm most interested at this point in the RAISE Act.
Another proposal I've heard put out is giving out amnesty to a significant portion of illegal immigrants in exchange for future reductions in legal immigration. Do you think something like that might be necessary for their like a compromise to get approval in the Senate?
Yeah, there is talk. You know, could there be a DACA deal, for instance, to get the RAISE Act through? I'm skeptical of amnesty bills only based on the history of them. You had mentioned the Reagan 1986 Amnesty Act. And before 1986, roughly 1 million immigrants would come north to work and 1 million immigrants would go south. It was seasonal work. But after the amnesty, people started to stay, thinking, well, you know, if I stay long enough, I might be able to participate in another amnesty. So I think it's a reward for bad behavior. Now, DACA is a little different. You have people that came here as minors, some of them, and that's a more difficult situation. In a way, I blame the parents. You come into a country illegally, and whether the motivation was, well, we'll bring a small child along that might increase our opportunity or, an opportunity to stay. But that is something that is going to require, I believe, some deliberation. Because, again, you're visiting the sins of the father upon the child, so to speak.
What are your thoughts on the mass exodus of the middle class out of California? And if you put aside immigration population growth, is the population numbers of people born in California actually declining? And your thoughts on the overall exodus of the middle class?
Well, you're talking to someone who left California last year. I had been living in Los Angeles. I lived there for 20 years.
Yeah, that's where I'm from.
Okay, so you understand. I think most people reach a point, and there have been all kinds of experiments on this at population, whether you go back to the Drosophila experiments in the 60s. There are pressures that just increase mentally, emotionally, physically, when you keep ratcheting up the numbers. And you've only to drive around Los Angeles and feel that. I was there, I went back for Politicon a month ago and was struck with the increase in traffic and the attitude of people. When you look, and I like what John Michael Greer, how he frames this. It's an issue of the wage-earning class versus the other classes. And it's on them whether we're looking at Southern California in the 21st century or Rome in the 4th century AD. It's always to the productive wage-earning classes that the greatest burdens hit and the less benefits are available to. Because they're really out on their own. I was meeting with some folks in Beverly Hills, and these are folks who've grown up in Los Angeles, are talking about leaving Los Angeles. I have a friend whose family has been in Los Angeles, the county, for 5 generations, and they're looking to leave. So there is a flight of what I believe is the productive class. We could look at the levels of poverty that are there in Los Angeles. For instance, Colin Cameron, who's a professor of economics, I believe, at UC Davis. And he attributed a large portion of California's poverty to the large number of immigrants. And his quote was, and I just pulled it up, "While many immigrants are well-educated and high-paid, there are also many immigrants who are low-skilled and have poor English skills," he noted. Indeed, according to the Public Policy Institute of California, California, with more than 10 million immigrants, has more than any other state, or one-fourth the nation's entire population of foreign-born residents. And that should tell us that unbridled immigration, legal and illegal, simply isn't working, because if it were, it'd be working in LA County better than anywhere else in the country, and it simply isn't.
Yes, to continue on that point, I mean, I've drive around LA, and at this point, it's indistinguishable from Tijuana.
Yeah, yeah. Go by MacArthur Park.
Yeah, exactly. MacArthur Park, especially. Yeah, go by.
And you look at the number. My last 2 years when I was in Los Angeles, because I lived my last 10 years there in the downtown area, and just the number of homeless encampments that were popping up under every underpass was just amazing to me. I was blown away, and I'm speaking anecdotally there, but the statistical evidence bears it out. There are more homeless people than ever. In fact, Ted Hayes, who is a homeless activist that I know in Los Angeles, said the up-and-coming neighborhood for African Americans is Skid Row. So all of these pressures, economic, social, environmental, mental, emotional, get pushed down to our most vulnerable, and they feel the brunt of it first. But everyone feels it.
Right. Is there like anything happening in LA as far as like, are there people trying to speak up from like the more like upper class white communities in LA about like, let's say, Eagle Rock or whatever, or Highland Park, like the gentrified neighborhoods? Are they generally continuing to support the whole drink the whole Kool-Aid of unbridled immigration and open borders and amnesty, or are they like are some people starting to wake up?
I would say no. The conversations that I had on immigration and those who were for restricting it are the same people I was having that conversation with a year ago. One person had told me that, "Kevin, progressives for immigration reform, that's a very Orwellian term."
Like, oh, yeah, I heard this. Are there even some article claim that you're like some right-wing plant?
Yeah, it was amazing. At that time, you know, our whole board is composed of African Americans. So it's pretty amazing. And I'm looking at her, and this is someone who's talking about leaving California themselves. But they won't acknowledge that it was this policy of unbridled immigration. And again, it hit California. When you look at, 27% of all immigrants that come to the U.S. come from Mexico, and half of them are in California.
What are your thoughts on the whole sort of new urbanist movement and the urbanist movement that is pushing more infill development as an alternative to sprawl? I'm generally supportive of a lot of the positive aspects of that, like having access to mass transit, creating walkable communities where you don't have to drive to go to your work. I think there's a lot of positive things coming out of it. But the other side of it is, I know a lot of pro-immigration liberals will use that as justification that if we only increase density, we can accommodate unlimited immigration. So in general, I'm very sympathetic to that movement, but there's that angle to it as well. Are you familiar with that issue?
I am in many respects. I'm living in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and it's one of the more improved small cities in the U.S., I would say. And last night, I was at an event where our outgoing mayor, Mayor Gray, was being honored by the community. And after 12 years, he chose not to run for re-election. And I had mentioned to him a couple months ago, he didn't attend the event that I had with James Howard Kunstler and Michael Greer and Chris Martinson and Dmitry Orlov and Frank Morris. But when I told him about it, he was with his wife, and his wife jumped out and goes, James Howard Kunstler, we love him. We've read his books. So when you look at the improvements that have happened to this city, I think a lot of it is because for the last 12 years, we had someone who was grounded in new urbanist thought at the helm. And I think that really helped in terms of our walkability scores now are in the 80s. So those things are important, but we got to make sure, because, you know, it's interesting when we look at what new urbanists want. Oftentimes on the way to implementation, it gets bastardized by developers and politicians. So they'll talk about revitalization, and revitalization will come in the form of some mega structure, whether it's a stadium or it's a large apartment complex or a garage to get more people to an area. And that's where the whole thing gets bastardized. If new urbanism at its best improves walkability, focuses on mass transit and accessible public spaces. So if you have a blighted community, the idea is not to tear it down and create cute shishi area with coffee shops and everything. Improve that area, improve its sidewalks, look at it from the streetscape. You know, would a human want to live here? And you'll find all of a sudden the people in these areas won't see the government as an enemy, but as someone who's working to improve their lives. And as Mayor Gray said last night when they talked, because he said, well, when over your 12 years, did you notice the biggest change, or what was the biggest change? And he said the biggest change was attitude. People got positive about their city. You know, whether it was an accessible government at a municipal level, or there was, you know, things just seemed to be improving. Well, I'm here and I'm the beneficiary of that kind of policy.
And back to places like LA and the San Francisco Bay Area, even if we were to dramatically reduce immigration levels to what the RAISE Act has, or even if we were to reduce it to a complete moratorium, I think you would still have this pressure of, for basically those middle-class people you were talking about who would be leaving California, there would still be a high housing demand. So I still think it is necessary to retrofit a lot of these more kind of run-down suburban areas into more walkable communities. So even with low levels of immigration, some cities would still have to address the housing demand. And I also think that cities like LA, it is important to improve public transportation.
Absolutely. My last 10 years in LA, I moved to the downtown largely to stop commuting by car. And I got to work by foot and bicycle. And that improved my standard of living significantly. My quality of life dramatically improved. And now one of the most expensive real estate markets in Los Angeles County is downtown Los Angeles, where a friend warned me that I wouldn't recognize the place when I went back. And frankly, it was hard to recognize.
Yeah, I live in Santa Barbara, but even in like a 2-year interval, it's changed that quick.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's, but boy, how to unravel this? I think it's going to be really hard. I just see a lot of pain coming because we've been trying to meet this demand. for housing. And yes, I think there always will be demand, but the demand for a suburban house that isn't connected by mass transit, where people can efficiently and effectively move to their job or get to where they want to socialize, I think the value of that kind of real estate is going to go down. And correspondingly, where you can have a community with high walkability, with social and employment locations that are close by, they're going to do really well. And that's certainly playing out in Los Angeles. And all indications are that the millennials and the generation following them is looking for places like that, and they're not looking at suburbia and everyone else's that kind of, I'll call it, stuff.
With all these issues we're talking about, do you ever kind of feel politically homeless? Because on one side you get Trump and his extreme anti-environmental stances and a lot of other negative aspects of Donald Trump that you could just go on and on about, but then Trump does support the RAISE Act. And then on the left side you get someone like Bernie Sanders who will back away from this issue because it's politically incorrect. So do you feel politically homeless, and do you think there is any feasibility of building a new political coalition?
Yes, that's actually a really good point. That's something I and others have been pondering for several months now. What do you do in the absence of a nuanced conversation when you can't? I am reminded by a quote out of Thucydides, where he mentions that, you know, anyone who wasn't radically on one side versus the other was thought to be a traitor. And it's difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to defend a lot of things that Trump is doing. I mean, certainly during the election, I think if he would have just stuck to where the facts when it comes to the need to bridle immigration and reduce legal immigration and work to completely rid ourselves of illegal immigration, the economic and labor and environmental issues would really win out, would have won out for him. But there he was talking about Mexicans being rapists. No, they're not. I mean, and if you live in Los Angeles, most of your neighbors and many of your friends are probably Mexican. And for him to make a statement like that, it was just awful. You know, it was cringe, and it made this nuanced conversation that needs to happen all the more difficult. So, and then on the other aspect, as you said, he supports the RAISE Act. But I never saw myself as really just a one-issue person. My hope for Trump going in, you know, in the best case scenario, was he would be some kind of iconoclast who would rip out the corporatocracy or certainly shake it around significantly. But that doesn't even seem to be happening at this point.
It's interesting because he's taken these different positions. At one point, he was for single payer and raising taxes on billionaires. But now pretty much on most issues, he's in line with the standard Republican agenda.
Yeah, and the only saving grace to date has been he hasn't taken us to war, but that could change overnight. That could change with a tweet, unfortunately. Yes, but you asked, okay, so where do we go from here? Okay, what if there are movements afoot, and I have been talking to a number of people. One person is literally talking about dropping the progressive moniker from their nom de guerre because they just don't want to be associated with a lot of aspects of the Democratic Party, which is its loyalty to the corporatocracy and the deep state and the shenanigans they play. And I can certainly understand that. You know, a positive to the Republicans, at least, you know, sadly, we got Donald Trump, but they overthrew the candidates that were being force-fed to them. So what do you do? There are movements afoot. One of them is the Unrig movement. which is the combination of Steele and McKinney, reaching out and looking, talking to issues that unite, several issues that at least most of us can unite on. The need to, for instance, to have these banksters thrown in jail, the need to provide adequate health care, the need to stop these failed foreign ventures, the need to invest in infrastructure at home. So there are movements afoot, and I think that's the positive thing going on. Whether or not we'll be able to organize effectively, particularly if tools like YouTube and Facebook become unavailable to us, I'm not sure.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add about your organization, Progressives for Immigration Reform, in case people want to get involved in?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The site is pfirdc.org, and I would recommend going to our page with our H-1B database and taking a look at that. I think that everyone will find that really helpful. Also, as I'd mentioned earlier, we created an environmental impact study. I'd recommend going to that page and learning more about our EIS and what we're going to be doing in the future to roll that out and disseminate that. And if you go to our site, again, pfirdc.org, go to immigration topics, you can find the H-1B database. And you can also find the environmental impact study.
Kevin, Lynn, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This was great. And we'll talk soon. I'm actually going to be in Santa Barbara in November. So perhaps we can get together for a cup of coffee.
That sounds excellent. And thanks, Sam Gavorkian.
You're welcome.
Thanks.